From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today, our guest Epicurean correspondent, Jolene Ketzenberger from the Indianapolis Star, will pay us a visit.
She'll have two interviews, the first with restaurant consultant Peter George.
And then with chef Lydia Bastionic.
Then I'll chat with the new director of Encore Vocal Arts, and we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. It's hard to believe that it was just about a year ago when Super Bowl 46 descended onto Indianapolis. And in the glow of the game, the Indianapolis dining scene enjoyed the spotlight as well. Celebrity Neil Patrick Harris joked on Twitter that he couldn't get a table at renowned restaurant St. Elmo's or even the Steak and Shake across the street. And the How I Met Your Mother star did finally find a table in South Broad Ripple at a local restaurant called Recess, as did late-night host Jimmy Fallon. American Idol alums Kelly Clarkson and Carrie Underwood were each spotted dining at local hotspots Black Market and Late Harvest Kitchen, so it's no surprise that after the Super Bowl has come and gone, Indianapolis' dining scene keeps shining. Jolene Ketzenberger, food writer for the Indianapolis Star, is joining us as a guest today. She recently sat down with former Indianapolis restaurateur and current restaurant consultant Peter George to find out what dining trends to expect in 2013 and how the Indianapolis dining scene has changed since he opened his first restaurant in Indianapolis over 25 years ago.
I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, food writer for the Indianapolis Star, and today I am talking food with former restaurateur Peter George, current restaurant consultant Peter George. Peter, it's good to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. It's nice to see you.
Well, with some Indianapolis restaurants now included in the 2013 Zagat Guide to America's Top Restaurants, some local chefs are starting to get more national attention. So I can't help but wonder, what is the state of the city's dining scene right now? So you opened Peter's restaurant in Fountain Square in 1985. So tell me, what was it like then? What was the dining scene like when you came to town?
It was an exciting time, I think, for Indianapolis because it was really the beginning of the birth of the city. What was taking place is that there were a number of people like myself. Fletcher Boyd was one of the other restaurateurs, and there were a number of other people that I think we had a vision of bringing some modern cuisine to the city.
So what sort of restaurants were here then? What kind of food was being served?
You know, the King Cole was downtown, and of course,
right.
St. Elmo's, which has been there for, you know, 100 plus years, and the Glass Chimney was on the north side. There was a lot of country club dining
exactly.
that was taking place at that time. But for the most part, other than a few national chains, there was not a lot of hubbub in the restaurant scene. There just wasn't a lot going on.
So what vision did you have coming in 1985? What kind of food were you wanting to serve?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I had close friends from college that lived down here, and so I used to come down a couple of times a year. And I'd always say, hey, take me to, you know, something new. Take me to something that you really think is great. And so they would take me to restaurants, and I thank them for doing it, expose me to what they thought was really something, you know, special. And I kept being disappointed. I was just, time after time, I'd say, well, gosh, we're up in little old South Bend. And, you
know, right, and that's where you're from, right?
Yes. And I was, at that time, running our family restaurant, the Carriage House, which my sister still owns
sure.
and operates.
Very well-known restaurant. South
yeah.
Bend.
And so I kept saying, well, gosh, we've been doing more than this for the last couple, 2 or 3 years. And I was just like wanting more.
Sure.
And so that was really the reason why I moved here. I thought I could really do two things. I thought I could bring a fresher outlook to the food. And I really thought that I could improve the overall service and what people expected of service in a really great restaurant.
So how was the menu at Peter's different from what people were used to?
Well, first of all, it was much smaller. It was one page, and it changed daily. And mainly, that was for a number of reasons. We wanted to show a lot of different food products, and we wanted to keep the interest level high. But also, big problem was we couldn't buy any food here. There were no food purveyors locally that were offering. For instance, in South Bend, there was an ongoing farmers market already. It had been going for 60 years at the time. And there were probably 200 purveyors at that farmers market. So you could get what you wanted. Was it what you could get in Europe? Probably not. But it was certainly fresh, and it was certainly off the farm, and it was certainly super high quality. We couldn't find that here.
And that probably led to your seeking out of local vendors and then eventually starting a farmer's market, right?
Really, it is. I can remember how much money and time we spent on flying seafood in, flying Maytag blue cheese, because not one purveyor in town had it. All those little things that became big things were so important to try to produce the type of food and the menu that we were looking at doing. And then, of course, I ran into Ross Ferris.
Oh, exactly. Ross Ferris of your neighbor's garden. It was a wonderful longtime vendor here in Indianapolis.
Yeah. Ross was certainly just a great guy and, you know, appreciated fresh food. And we became fast friends. And, you know, I think it was 1994, I talked to him about opening a farmer's market. And he said, well, when do you want to do it? And I said, well, I'm thinking about a week from Saturday. And this was on Thursday. And he goes, I could see him rolling his eyes sort of, but not really, and saying, well, okay, I think we could probably do that. And so we did. We opened the first farmer's market.
In the parking lot, right?
Yeah, right on the front sidewalk of Peter's restaurant up on the north side. And it was a big success immediately. And it was fun.
So perhaps is that one way that maybe the dining public has changed, they're much more interested in farmers markets and the whole local food movement?
I think so. I think we've got people who appreciate fresh food, know what to do with it. They're not afraid to experiment with it. They're fantastic cooks in their own right. So their expectations of fresh quality food have definitely risen over the past, 25 years. That's what you want. I mean, you want that palate to be educated.
So diners expect more in terms of food. What about service? Service is where Indianapolis gets dinged a lot of times from people here, people elsewhere. What do you think about service and what that means in terms of fine dining?
Well, that term fine dining is an elusive term, and I'm not sure that we have a tremendous amount of fine dining establishments or restaurants. I think that fine dining, that stiff, formal, draped napkin over your arm, which,
right,
by the
right.
way, that's not what I was not a proponent of that in my restaurants.
Right.
Although the service was definitely there. It was kind of in the background, but I'll use the word attack, but only in a light manner. When necessary, but I don't know if we have a lot of fine dining. I think what we've got is a tremendous amount of fine food.
So the restaurants in the upcoming Zagat Guide include Recess, the top food-rated restaurant here in Indianapolis, according to the guide, but it also includes Late Harvest Kitchen, Bluebeard, Black Market as well. I would also add on those as far as supporters of local food and the whole farm-to-table concept. I would also add in Our Bistro. So I think these restaurants are certainly good examples of where people can go to sort of get a taste of the whole farm to table, the whole chef-driven notion, changing menus, that sort of thing.
Yeah, but there's another farm to table restaurant which you wouldn't really expect, and that's Napoli's. If you look at their menu, it's definitely derived from local goods. It's just delivered to you on a crust. And so you think of it being a town, well, how can that be farm to table? But if you go in there, it truly is.
Now, that's very interesting. So the whole farm to table concept has even become embraced by restaurants serving, what you would call very casual fare, pizza, pastas, that sort of thing.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah. And I think that is a continuing trend for 2013, is a continuing emphasis on local food and farmers markets. Also, one of the interesting trends that we have been seeing is an emphasis on cocktails. And according to the pundits, in 2013, we will see even more culinary sort of cocktails. We might be over the whole pre-prohibition kind of classic drinks, but I expect we'll see some more creativity in the bar area. Now, that's a big part of a restaurant, right?
Well, no question. Mixology, craft cocktails, craft beers.
Oh, absolutely.
Look how many breweries have opened up in Indianapolis in the last 5 years. It's just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. The craft cocktails, the craft beers are certainly a force. But we still have to go back to Mother Nature, which is wine.
Exactly. It's terrific to get to talk to you about this and get your insights on what's going on. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
That's restaurant consultant Peter George chatting with Indianapolis Star food writer Jolene Ketzenberger. George is currently consulting in Indianapolis, and each week you can read Jolene Ketzenberger's work in the Indianapolis Star.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. Chef Lydia Bastianek, host of Lydia's Italy in America and regular contributor to public television cooking show lineup since 1998, will be visiting Indianapolis next month. In preparation for her visit, Indianapolis Star food writer Jolene Ketzenberger caught Lydia for a phone conversation, and she just happened to be preparing soup at her home in Queens, New York.
Thought we could talk food for a few minutes.
Absolutely. I was making a soup, and I just got so involved. I was chopping the vegetables and so on.
Well, anyway, so thank you for agreeing to talk with us. What I like about your books and your shows and your efforts is that you're not dismissive of our attempts to cook Italian. Do you feel like American cooks are making progress in cooking?
Absolutely. You know, I've been in business, I think, in the restaurant and cooking since 71. My television and all that is actually began in books in 81 when I opened for Lydia. And I've seen a tremendous increase knowledge, interest in my customers in the restaurants, but now, you know, the ones that buy the books, that come to my book signing, that watch the TV show, that ask questions on the website. It's a great improvement. America is really conscious about, and they want to know ever more, eating well, eating healthy, and, you know, Italian is a fun cuisine.
It is a fun cuisine, and it always ranks as one of our top favorite types of cooking. What sort of things would you like to see American cooks learn more about?
I think, you know, it's really what a lot of the chefs are saying. You know, cook seasonal. Whatever it's in season, it's the best. You know, now my soup, what did I do? I put in squash and dry porcini mushrooms and kale, you know, the Italian black kale, cabbage, all of this, you use what's in season. So I would like them to really feel comfortable with the product. Don't marry yourself to a product. Marry yourself to a product in the season. It is buy local. You know, if it comes locally, it's great. It is usually much more nutritious because, you know, it's closer when it's harvested to you. It's closer. It is usually cheaper. It doesn't have to fly half a globe to get to you.
Right.
And so seasonal, local, don't be afraid of, use a lot of roots vegetables, especially now, whether it's carrots, whether it's turnips. Also, what I would like to tell them is, especially in the wintertime, the dry legumes.
Oh, sure.
Yes. You know, in my soup, what I did, since we're on the soup, I took some cecchi, some garbanzo beans.
Right.
I soaked them last night before I went to bed, and this morning they were nice and plump. And then I put in some split peas and some lentils. So what the split peas, you know, we all know the split pea soup, but if you throw in some in a minestrone or in any other vegetable, it disintegrates, and it gives nice density. Dry fava beans, you know, they're... make sure sometimes the dry fava beans have the outer shell,
right,
and sometimes they're without. If you see them kind of split open, that means that they're without the shell, and if you cook them, they are going to disintegrate and give you a wonderful sweetness, give you nutrition, It's economically sensible. So, seasonal vegetables, you know, wintertime, the deep green vegetables are so great.
The roots,
the cabbage family, and the dry legume.
Well, I think that sounds like a fabulous soup. It's a perfect time of year to cook soup.
All right.
now, what makes me think of comforting things in the middle of winter to cook something like that? What are some of your ideas of comfort food?
Well, exactly. You know, it is seasonal. Comfort food is within the season. And as you say now, you know, I love my soups. I love when it's perking in the house. The whole house smells really good.
And then,
you know, that sort of. Well, you don't need much on the side. You know, you can plop a sausage in there towards the end if you want and have that with the, you have your vegetables and everything
else.
So, you know, a little sausage with some fresh horseradish on top and mustard. It's just delicious. So, I like that as comfort food. Polenta. Polenta is very comforting for me. Pasta also is very comforting for me. Braised meats now in the winter.
My goodness.
Yeah, that long cooking processes now in the winter, that's what's, it's velvety, it's kind of, you know, kind of stick to the mouth feel.
Right, and those sorts of dishes are what the family will remember, too.
It's a whole because the house smells of it, and it's a great, these dishes are great because you can make them, and you let them sit in there, and they get even better. So when your family comes, let's say that, you know, you have Sunday a dinner for 12. You put a big pot of soup, you put a braised piece of meat on, whether it's lamb, whether it's beef, that's done. And you can have your vegetables, you know, done or potatoes, and you can sit and enjoy the family. You put the soup on the table, everybody has a great plate or two of soup, and then the meat, you slice it, you put it in the sauce, and again, bring it to the table. No last-minute kind of tension.
Exactly. Because I hate that not being able to enjoy the family if they're there. Now, is there a quintessential Italian dish that a young American cook should want to know how to make? Something that defines Italian?
Well, you know, pasta defines Italian. Everybody thinks, you know, of pasta. And pasta, it's really easy. It's not difficult. And I'm talking about dry pasta.
Okay.
You know, you can get into making fresh pasta, which is quite easy as well. But, you know, some of the easiest, you know, if you have spaghetti, even garlic and oil or spaghetti clam sauce.
Sure.
It's so simple. You know, again, just the ingredients. Get yourself some good pasta. Make sure that it's 100% durum wheat,
okay.
That it is a nice dry pasta, because dry pasta, you know, it's simple, but it could be complicated. And then that the other ingredients, good olive oil, clams nice and fresh, the ingredients dictate. And then don't be afraid to be simple. Don't be afraid to be simple. There are little points, you know, I mean, if you go to my website or my books, what I'm told is that I empower people because, you know, even though I'm a chef, cooking is not a big mystery. You know, all of us need to eat, so we all have a connection to food. It's just kind of feeling more comfortable, educating yourself a little bit. And then trial and error, you know. I mean, I have 40 years of practice.
I love that. I love that, though, because so often I think some of the famous chefs make it a very complicated and mysterious thing to know how to cook. And everyone can do it, right?
Everybody can cook. I feel that everybody can cook. And they need that confidence, you know, and I would like to empower them, really. And you begin, first of all, I think, food of memories of home. It's a great way to start because you have recollect the flavors,
sure.
The aromas, and the memory. So, you know, don't be afraid. Try the recipe maybe that you loved that your mother made. You will eventually get it, you know. And it doesn't have to be restaurant perfect. It has to be good for you and your family. And as long as it's good, people love it, there's always room to grow and improve.
Well, that's true. That is very empowering. It's inspiring, and it makes people want to actually get in the kitchen and cook something.
Yeah, you know, garlic and oil. Spaghetti, garlic and oil. So.
Oh, there we go. Well, now see that's something everybody should feel like they could do that.
Yes, there's a little catch, and I share it all the time. So
okay.
You put your water for the pasta.
Right.
Water should be salted, and there should be abundant. And follow the instruction on the box. How long does the pasta cook? That's as easy as that. The sauce usually takes for spaghetti, garlic, and oil as long as the pasta cooks.
Okay.
So you throw in the pasta, you mix it, you let it boil, time it. Separately, you start with a good olive oil, slice of garlic, raise the flame slowly. Don't get the oil hot and then throw in the garlic.
All right.
Get plenty of garlic, let it be nice and golden. I put a little peperoncino, red pepper. I love the little red flakes. When the garlic is golden, I take my ladle and I take 2-3 ladles of pasta cooking water and throw it in the pan with the garlic and oil. And that will zoom, you know, kind of puff up. And you let that simmer. Add a little parsley in there and a little bit of salt. You can or cannot have the anchovies if you like. Mm-hmm. And that will simmer away into a little sauce. By the time the pasta is done, strain it, throw it in the sauce, toss it well, add some cheese. You got yourself an excellent dish.
Oh, my goodness. That sounds so good.
Try that.
I am. I absolutely am. Now, after...
Parsley. Don't forget chopped parsley. You know, throw that.
Oh, it sounds wonderful. But, you know, I wonder, after all this time cooking, you know, in the kitchen for your family, for your customers, are there things that you still want to learn about and get better at?
Oh, yes. It's endless. I mean, you know, the Italian, I go back to Italy at least 4 or 5 times a year, you know, and I have family and we have the wine every day.
Sure.
And I can tell you, Italy has 20 regions. And I, you know, I scour them all up and down, different season, and I always come back with new ideas, with new flavors. So you would say Italy is maybe the size of half of California.
Right.
And yet I continue all these years, 30, 40 years, to go back, and I continue to be stimulated and find new ideas. Not that they are new contemporary ideas, although I look at those, what is Italy doing, but these are traditions, actually traditions, that, you know, maybe I have not seen before. Maybe this little town, it makes it different than the other little town. And then I build upon that. So not only that, not only Italy, you know, I mean, the chemistry of food, the nutritional value of food, all of that interests me, you know, as a chef and feeding people and teaching people how to cook. I love that consciousness. So I do, absolutely. And then the other cultures.
Oh, sure.
You know, I'm faithful to the Italian because I'm, you know, I feel responsible on transmitting the Italian culture. But I want to know about the other cultures. So I do a lot of traveling. Food reflects topography, geography, reflects climate, reflects everything.
It really does. Are there some more things that we could look forward to? Are there more books on the way? Are there things you're thinking about?
You know, I just, I mean, this year we came out with Lydia's Favorites.
Exactly.
Next year is a book, sort of Lydia's, and we're still working on the title. You know how titles they are. But it's sort of a kind of a wisdom in the kitchen. You know, all the things that are so logical that we think, oh, my God, this is a chef's trick. No, just, you know, use logic in the kitchen, and usually it works. So sharing all of those things on how to approach it, the kitchen, and what is really logical, the cooking that can come from within you, and you should be comfortable. You should certainly know some of the basics and all of that. But I think this is the next book, all the recipes and all the kind of things that, see, this is not that hard. It's very common. And so that's the next book, with recipes and, you know, the wisdom, how to freeze things, the herbs, you know, you take basil, for example, you have a lot of it in the summer, and how do you keep it fresh in the winter? It's expensive.
Right.
You know, if you take all that, those extra leaves, and you kind of put, let's say, even ice, an ice tray with water, and you submerge the leaves, and you freeze them within the ice, they remain beautiful and green, and all you need to is plop the ice cube in whatever you're cooking, and you have your basil. So little things like that, you know, really, really kind of things that could be very helpful for the home cook.
I think it would be helpful, and so many people are coming back to cooking, and they want to know these things.
Yes, exactly. So that's the next thing. I have a children's book coming out in the spring.
Oh, that will be fun. Tell me about that.
That's my second children's book. This next book is Nonna Tell Me a Story, and celebrating my mother, who's 93, so celebrating her birthday. She's still alive.
Oh, my goodness.
And my five grandchildren, we go and we decide on the menu that we're going to make. And, of course, you know, things come out like peanut butter and this. But then we go to the market, and I address through this the seasons, you know, the different seasons and what are the vegetables and how to appreciate it and how to make a dish within each season. And I give them recipes to do that. So, you know, teaching the children through a story. And in the stories, I tell them, because, you know, I grew up with my grandmother and we had a garden, and how, you know, the springtime, the peas, I would go collect the little peas still sweet. And, you know, the summer, the tomatoes and the Swiss chards, the whatever, the spinach. And then the fall, we were going to forage for mushrooms and how we would dry the beans and then use them in the wintertime, the dry legumes and all of that. So I go through the four seasons with my experience as a child and ultimately give them recipes that they and their mother or grandmother can cook with them.
Oh, how wonderful. What a nice tie-in with your thoughts on seasonality and the importance of family and cooking. I think that sounds wonderful.
Yeah, if you go on my website, you will, I think it's so you can get more on it and the exact name, because again, names, you know, but it's Nonna Tell Me a Story, and it's a birthday, seasonal birthday or something like that.
Well, we will we'll be looking for that, and I hope people get a chance to come out and see you when you are in town on February the 7th. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us a little bit.
Thank you. And, you know, I'm so sorry but my soup is just about finished.
Oh, that's terrific. I'm sure it's going to be a fabulous soup, and you've inspired me to go home and make one of my own. So
yes, do it.
thank you again so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Lydia's Italy in America airs Saturday afternoons at 2:30 on WFYI-1 Public Television. Chef Lydia Bastianek will be at Clark Appliance in Castleton on Thursday evening, February 7th from 6 to 8, signing her latest book, Lydia's Favorite Recipes. Space is limited, so make sure you RSVP by calling 715-2009, that's 715-2009, or you can email membership@WFYI.org, again, membership@WFYI.org. Be sure to catch Lydia's latest PBS special coming to WFYI Public Television in March. For recipes, information on books, TV shows, restaurants, products, and trips to Italy, visit Lydia's official website, lydiasitaly.com. And Lydia is spelled L-I-D-I-A, so lydiasitaly.com. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
You like to laugh. I know this about you.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do. The only thing you like as much as magic.
Yeah.
And I knew you
and
enjoyed the Midwinter Magic Festival last
week.
Yes,
I did. And I was laughing at that.
You were laughing
were
at that.
Funny,
and
yes.
You were wowed because you saw two tricks that you didn't know how they were done at all, which is saying a lot because you know a lot about magic yourself. Anyway, you enjoy laughing as well. And I have something on our calendar segment that's bound to make you laugh.
You sure?
I
want to hear it.
I am
okay.
Sure.
That calendar segment that we call What Do We Do? What do you got there?
Well, I can't believe that Comedy Sports Indianapolis is 20. They're almost legal.
Almost.
Well, depending on how you define legal.
That's pretty cool.
Drinking age or voting age.
Wow.
Yeah, they're celebrating 20 years in Indianapolis.
Happy birthday to them.
Happy birthday to them.
And that will make you laugh.
It will make you laugh a lot. They're actually celebrating with a big old party on Saturday, February 9th. It's an anniversary gala. They'll have a red carpet hour, an awards ceremony, and an all-star comedy sports match. Find out more at IndieComedySports.com. And if you've ever been there, you probably remember that sports is spelled S-P-O-R-T-Z.
Z.
So Z. IndieComedySports.com. Stay tuned. We'll be talking with some of the comedy sports folks about how they've survived 20 years and never repeated a line.
Pretty amazing.
On an upcoming Art of the Matter.
That's what they say.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, so not this weekend, but next weekend, of course, is First Friday. In February is February 1st, and there are lots of gallery openings and lots of cool stuff going on. One thing that I am really interested in is going on at the Arts Council's Gallery 924, excuse me, and they are having an artist, it's an installation by artist Thomas Lewis, and from what I've heard, it's unlike anything that they have ever done in the studio before.
I'm intrigued.
It includes some 3D projections, but the the focal point, if you will, of the show is a huge tree that's in the middle of the gallery. And I've seen some photographs of it. Sharon, this is a, we're not talking like just a little fig tree in a pot. We're talking, this is a an enormous, huge tree that the artist has installed in the middle of the gallery.
Hmm.
It's going to be pretty cool.
I'm
excited about it. So that opening is, of course, next Friday the 1st, February 1st at Gallery 924 at 924 North Pennsylvania.
Shocking. It would be at 924 yes. North Penn.
Funny how that works. So artist Thomas Lewis. Yeah.
Indeed. Speaking of First Friday, there's an Indianapolis ceramic artist named Lori Lomont who launched an art project because she looked around and realized there weren't very many strong, diverse, well-rounded female characters in popular media. And she came up with this project, which is called The Girl Stories. Her idea was to create sculptures of non-stereotypical female characters who have great stories and to inspire girls and women to tell stories of their own by making art. And so what she did was she organized this 8-week-long clay workshop with Big Brothers Big Sisters of Central Indiana and made free art classes available to young women in the mentoring program. And on Friday, February 1st, First Friday, the results of the project and the workshop will be on display at the Wheeler Art Center. So you may not necessarily have the Wheeler Art Center on your First Friday radar screen, but you should put it on there. The opening is from 6 to 9. It's free and open to the public, and there will be some music, and of course you can talk to all the artists, including Lori, who had this idea for the Girl Project.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very neat. Hey, something else that is happening on First Friday, if you will, it's actually a deadline, and that is the deadline for the ISO to raise a whole bunch of money
to
be able to keep things going the way that we all want them to keep going. And if you've been wondering, well, how do I support the ISO, because they're trying to raise $5 million by February 1st, and last I heard, they're about maybe a million or so to go. I'm not sure that exact figure, but one way you can do it, of course, is just go to any of the concerts, but a really fun way, Sharon, that I suggest you and I go out for. You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Next Tuesday night on January 29th from 6 to 10 p.m. at the Chatterbox Jazz Club, they're having a whole bunch of ISO classical musicians come in for a classical music jam. And the suggested donation is $10 at the door, and all the money raised that night will go to support the ISO.
Get there early. The box isn't very
Get
big.
Get there early, I know. So 6 to 10, Tuesday night at the Chatterbox. That's on Mass Ave in the 400 block. Next Tuesday night should be a ton of fun. I'm looking forward to this.
Fantastic. And even if you can't go to that, or even if you can, you can call 639-4300 to make your gift by phone. 639-4300. They're working with a challenge grant right now that will match your pledge. And so we need to keep the ISO going, so
yes.
Do your part. So if you want to show your own artwork on a First Friday, maybe you want to take in this next event, which is going to happen a couple of times. It's called Art and Chardonnay. You can enjoy an evening of dinner and wine paired with an art class at the Propylaeum. Yes, you're going to have your wine, and then you're going to make art. You know, loosen up the creativity and all that. It's an elegant Victorian setting. If you've never been in the Propylaeum, this is a great excuse to go there. Decadent food, salad, your choice of three magnificent main courses, a glass of wine, and a divine dessert. And you're going to work with an experienced painter after dinner to create your own painting. This is going to happen a couple times, February 6th and the 15th at 6:30 p.m. And you can find out more online. Just Google Art and Chardonnay Indianapolis.
That's pretty fun.
Yeah.
Hey, if you happen to miss Freetown Village's new show that they've been putting together on Madam C.J. Walker. In fact, they performed it on Martin Luther King Day.
They did.
At the Madam Walker Center. Well, they are going to continue to do this Thursdays through February. February 7th, 14th, 21st, 28th. Every Thursday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., you can learn about the story of Madam C.J. Walker from members of Freetown Village who are going to be performing this with a new character they've created to bring her story to life. Admission is free, donations are accepted, and it takes place at the Madam Walker Center on Indiana Avenue, 10 to 2 on Thursdays in February.
And now for something completely different, the Indie Folk Series has a group coming up that actually sounds like it has something to do with roller derby. It's a group called Whipstitch Sallies. I know you can see Drew Barrymore and company flying on their roller skates around the bout. But no, this is actually a music group. It's a four-piece string band, heavy on the harmonies, and
They are kind of a new jazz, kind of hard to describe, actually. A little bit of country, a little bit of soul, a little bit of bluesiness. It's all the Whip Stitch Sallies, and they're going to be in Indy on Saturday night, February 16th, courtesy of Indy Folk Series. Find out more at indiefolkseries.org.
And I just want to give a shout out to the Pride of Indy Band, which marched in the 2013 presidential inaugural parade, which is really cool. They were also part of the 2008 parade, and these 9 folks from Indy have been in D.C. to play and march, and it's very cool. And so congratulations to the Pride of Indy Band.
If you have a young person in your life, a high school young man or woman who is interested in architecture and design, don't forget that AIA Indiana is sponsoring their Indiana High School Architectural Design Competition, and you can find out more about that online. The deadline is coming up fairly soon, so if you need to get a young person in your life inspired, go online and learn more about the Indiana High School Architectural Design Competition.
Very good. Hey, last thing I have, Sharon, is Super Bowls. Not the ones with NFL players, but the ones that
care this year.
Are filled with
sorry.
With soup. That's right. Soup. Second Helpings is having their Super, that's S-O-U-P-E-R, Bowls 2013 this Saturday, the 26th, from 11:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Second Helpings location, the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Center on Southeastern Avenue, just off of East Washington Street. And it's a really cool thing because $5 entry gets you 5 soup tastings. You can also buy additional tastings, and they have soups from Greg Hardesty from Recess and Kathy Jones from Yozo's and Chip Huckabee from Bartos Catering and Anasantisi from Saffron Cafe and Miguel Cordero from the Northside Social, and also lots of beautiful bowls that you can buy made by artists, which is really fun too.
You're
so
making me hungry.
Get there
Stop
early.
It.
Well, let's get there. 11:30 a.m. on Saturday, 11:30 till 2, Super Bowls, a benefit for Second Helpings.
Eat your soup so you have plenty of energy to go out and do something in the arts this week, and join us again. We'll be back next week with more of that calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
After a decade under the guidance of Chris Ludwa, Encore Vocal Arts recently turned its baton over to Dr. Gregory Risto. He is also director of choral activities at DePaul University School of Music, where he conducts the Chamber Singers and University Chorus and teaches classes in choral conducting and choral literature. Dr. Risto also serves as conductor of the Interlochen Singers and teaches at the Interlochen Arts Camp in Interlochen, Michigan. Sharon Gamble invited Gregory into our studios to welcome him to Indianapolis.
So how did the music bug grab you?
You know, actually, I come from a very musical family. And so when I was young growing up, my parents were really hippies. And so I grew up with my dad playing guitar and mandolin. Aww. And actually jazz piano as well.
Interesting combination.
Right?
Yeah.
His mother had been a piano teacher. And actually, she was my first piano teacher. And she, I think, never quite got over the fact that dad had stopped doing classical music and turned to the dark side of jazz and folk
stuff.
Music.
Right,
oh, exactly.
Bless her heart.
So I was around music a lot growing up and started piano lessons at a very young age. And then went off to college where I studied music and just seemed a relatively natural progression for me. I had intended to not study music when I first went to Oberlin.
Because? Wait a minute. You went to Oberlin intending not
know,
to study
right,
music?
Right, yeah.
Hold on a second.
And I started in the college there, actually. But I realized by about the end of the first semester, I was taking mainly classes in the conservatory, and I couldn't stop practicing, and I was playing for several musicals. And so anyway, one thing led to another. I auditioned for the conservatory there and switched over, and yeah.
So do you have siblings?
No, I'm an only child.
Okay, yeah. So all the music from the parental units and the grandparental units got
That's
poured
right.
into you.
That's right, yeah.
Singing as well as playing?
Yes, although that came later for me. I started college as a pianist, and they said, okay, you're a pianist, therefore for your ensemble, you'll sing in a choir. And prior to that, I'd never sung in a choir before. And I was in the big symphonic chorus there at Oberlin, and I discovered I loved it. I loved the music. I loved singing. And I was working with singers quite a lot. I played for a lot of music theater and accompanied in a lot of the voice studios as well. And slowly that became more and more a part of my life. I started taking voice lessons on the side. And then gradually I'd always thought I was going to become a music theater pianist and conductor, and that didn't happen. I had the opportunity a few times, and sort of discovered when I got to play some longer runs of shows that by the 14th or 15th show, I was ready to start a new show.
And, sure, because you can't mix it up and make it new because people are depending on you to be exactly at that tempo.
That's right.
Because
that's
the right. Choreography is timed out and the cues are timed out.
Exactly so. Yeah. Exactly, yeah.
How does working with an ensemble like Encore Vocal Arts fit in with your, what I assume is a pretty full academic career? And it's not as though you have any lack of fine singers around you at the university.
DePaul, that's right, yeah. It's a great compliment to that. I love, you know, in the summers I teach at Interlochen Arts Camp in Michigan, where I work with high school students.
Sure.
And of course, I have my college students at DePaul. And then working with Encore Vocal Arts, which is, you know, a chamber choir, we're about 32 singers, really some excellent singers from all different walks of life, but many of them themselves professional musicians. It's a great compliment working to my life in the sense that I'm working with singers who actually have, I mean, not that my college students don't have real lives, but they have more life experience.
Sure.
And they bring that to their music making as well. So that, you know, when we sing, you know, to take a somewhat tragic example, we sang the William Billings, David's Lamentations, which is about him losing his son, Absalom.
Right.
And just realizing, you know, when I'm working with a group like this, I'm working with a group where many of them, if not most of them, have children of their own. And they bring a much more human and personal connection to text from their life experience than my young college students who, you know, are just learning about love and things like that.
Or who might sing a requiem and not have lost anyone and therefore can't get it. Is there a time when sometimes having the history and the emotional wherewithal to understand the text is an obstacle?
Certainly. I think for a singer in particular, the singer's nightmare is being asked to sing at a funeral for someone you care about.
Oh.
Because your throat, I mean, we all know it. When we feel loss, we feel it in our chest, we feel it in our throat.
Sure.
And it absolutely robs you of your singing technique.
So sometimes you have to say, you have to just be a musician, you can't be a person now.
Right,
I mean,
right.
That sounds terrible, but...
No, but it's very true. And, you know, actors think about this a lot, and I talk about it with my singers also, that the rehearsal process is there to let us dive into that emotional side of music, to let us go through the experience of feeling all of those emotions ourselves, so that when we get to the performance, we'll be able to inspire those emotions in our listeners, but know that we have to keep just enough of a safe distance ourselves so that we do all the technical and musical elements as they were meant to be done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a complex, many-layered process.
Mm-hmm.
You, in addition to working with a lot of musicians in three dimensions, you run a website for ear training.
I do.
How did that get started, and how does it work? And...
It's musicalmind.org is the website.
Mm-hmm.
And that came about, I taught my first full-time teaching job, well, actually my second, my very first full-time teaching job was at Eastman, the Eastman School of Music, after I finished my master's. They had me teach ear training full-time there. And I got about halfway through the year, and I realized I couldn't just teach. I was teaching six ear training classes each semester.
Yikes.
I was living,
that's a heavy class load.
It was a very heavy class load. I was living and breathing ear training, and I loved it in a way, but I wasn't doing my own music making. And so
sure.
At that point, I started looking for conducting jobs, which is what my degrees are in. In any case, first real then long-term job after that was teaching at a community college in Texas, where I directed the choirs, and I taught ear training as well. And that was my course load, two choirs and two sections of ear training each semester. And I just kept finding the students needed more practice. And my dad, in addition to his folk musician side, was a computer programmer professionally.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And so growing up, I got a lot of that as well. And I thought, oh, you know what? I bet I could learn Java pretty quickly and write apps to teach people ear training. And little by little, I just... You know, as things would come up in class, I'd say, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had an app that did this? And so I'd run home and -1 off. And yeah, that site has taken on a life of its own. I don't update it all that much anymore, but it gets about 1,000 hits a day, which...
Oh my gosh!
Right? It's sort of unbelievable to me. I think I can't believe there are that many people out there who want to have ear training practice.
So for someone who has no experience, can you define ear training for us?
Sure. It's basically being able to look at a piece of music and without playing it on the piano or hearing someone play it for you, be able to sing it or hear it in your head, or the reverse of it, that if I hear something on the radio, I could grab music paper and I could just write it down in the same way that if you were speaking to me in English, I could write down what you were saying. It's just being able to go from the written notation to the sound without having the help of an instrument in between.
You know, musicianship is so fascinating because there's so many aspects of it, and we mm-hmm. all know musicians who are stronger in one area than another. I mean, there's some people who are rhythmically challenged, but you can put sheet music in front of them upside down and they can still play it from sight. You
right.
know, there are
yeah.
so many different skill sets. How do you help your students or your choir members at Encore Vocal Arts assess their own strengths and figure out what's missing in their portfolios?
Sure. I think like any other diagnostician, a lot of that comes from working with lots and lots of singers over the years and noticing, okay, I've heard these problems before, and what was I able to say that actually helped in that case in the past? Because as you say, there are so many musicianship, it's this combination of so many different little skills and pieces, and figuring out what one needs help is, I think, the half the battle. So that, you know, if I'm listening to a singer sight sing and they're out of rhythm, that could be a rhythmic issue. I mean, it could be that they have trouble reading and counting, but it could also be not a rhythmic issue, but it could be that they can't summon to mind the sound of the note that they need to sing in time to sing it. And
uh-huh.
so it becomes out of time. And for whatever reason, one of the things I'm a little gifted at is knowing just when someone's sight singing,
what is it?
Their expressions sort of tell me what the problem is. Oh, okay. It's not that they have bad rhythm. It's simply they can't recall the fourth note of a major scale easily.
Or they might be singing in a language they're not that familiar with
sure.
and struggling with pronunciation
that's
and
right.
hesitating and
right.
coming
or there,
in late.
Or there might be a vocal technical issue that's making it difficult for them to sing certain notes in tune.
Sure.
Yeah.
And that's what makes you an educator.
Right. Yeah.
So going into undergraduate school at Oberlin, not intending to go into music.
Right.
Oh dear, you may regret that you said that out loud, although this probably isn't the first time you've said that. That's a far cry from going on to masters and doctorates in conducting. How did you go from piano to discovering you love singing to conducting? Because that's a whole other
right.
creature.
Right. Well, I had been conducting a bit in high school. I in 10th grade and in a string of budget cuts, the funding for our pep band was cut.
Oh.
Right? Terrible. And so I said, well, why don't I just get friends together and we'll make a pep band? And so by golly, we did. And so that was my first, conducting experience. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And, you know, for the first 3 years of my conducting career, I conducted 3/4 the wrong direction. It should go down, out, up, but I was always conducting it down, in, up, because, well, anyway, that was just...
But it worked.
They were able to follow, and I was mortified when I got to college and someone said, you know, Greg, it's actually meant to go down, out, up.
How long did it take you to get rid of that? I mean, that's 3 years. That's a lot
yeah.
of internalizing something the wrong
yeah.
direction.
It was, I guess it did take a year or two, now that I think about it. And sometimes I still put beats the wrong direction. I think we all do occasionally, but and fortunately, you know, with a pep band, there's not all that much music in 3/4. It's mainly marches
right.
and
you're
pop
getting
songs.
People riled up, not getting them to waltz.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah.
So fortunately, most of the repetition of my conducting was 4/4 or 2/4.
Sure.
You know, and those were going the right direction. So the conducting was there early on, and you know, working with singers in musicals and then singing in choirs myself in college, I found text. I love text. I love poetry. I love words. And so as I started thinking, you know, especially really towards my last few years of undergrad, I started thinking, well, how am I going to put all this together? How can I have great poetry and great music and conducting? And really.
And there it was.
And there it is.
Choral conducting. Yeah. What's your favorite moment as a conductor? Is there a favorite moment? Not of all time, but
in general. Yeah. People talk about flow, mm-hmm. The concept of flow
sure.
that Mihaly wrote about a lot. And this idea that when you're so involved with something and you don't even realize you're thinking about it anymore and the rest of the world sort of fades away. And yeah, I found that a lot as a pianist. I found it much easier to find on my own because I can set my own pace. But there are moments when that happens in performance with a choir where you can tell that it's not just you, but it's the whole ensemble in this sort of group flow and connection. Everyone is in the same mindset. And when that happens for me, that's what I live for, is creating that.
Sharon Gamble with Dr. Gregory Risto, Artistic Director of Encore Vocal Arts. You can see him in action at the ensemble's upcoming concert, The Myth, the Hero, and the Legend, on Saturday, February 9th at 8 o'clock at Zionsville United Methodist Church. The concert celebrates protagonists from Achilles to Harry Potter. Learn more at encorevocalarts.org. Again, encorevocalarts.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com. Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll take a look at the new Lincoln exhibit at the Indiana State Museum and learn about the Indiana Art Fair, also at the State Museum.
I'll hear about Musical of Musicals, the musical, at the Actors Theater of Indiana's Theater of Actors in Indiana.
Wait, let me guess. Is it a musical Actors Theater of Indiana is doing? I'll get a preview of the upcoming Carmel Gallery Walk, and we'll have our arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.